Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This episode of the Steve Austin Show is brought to you free in part by our friends at Geico. Go to geico.com and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at geico.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're gonna take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am currently out on vacation, recharging batteries, but just because I'm recharging the batteries, we still got business to take care of. In the meantime, we'll be playing some of the most requested Steve Austin Show classics that have been locked away in the archives. I got a great one for you this week, and here's my producer, Sean, to tell you all about it.
Thank you, Steve, and welcome to another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. Hello, it's producer Sean bringing you episode number 22 with Showtime, Eric Young, original air date June 20th, 2013. Eric Young, most well-known to WWE fans these days as the leader of the group Sanity, as they are featured on SmackDown and started out in NXT, where Eric Young is a former NXT Tag Team Champion. But a lot of wrestling fans do know of Eric Young from his time in TNA and Impact Wrestling. He is a former TNA World Champion, a former TNA and NWA Tag Team Champion, a former X Division Champion, a former TNA Legends / Global / TV Champion, and he is the longest reigning Knockouts Tag Team Champion with ODB, and he was stripped of that title on the date that this show aired, June 20th, 2013. So Eric has a very storied history with TNA, and Steve and him do talk about it a little bit. And they also talk about Eric's experience as the host of Off the Hook Extreme Catches on Animal Planet. I do not believe it's on anymore, but it did air for two seasons, and Eric is on this podcast today with Steve talking about the second season, which is about to debut when the show aired, and they do talk about fishing and outdoor life and just production of outdoor shows, something that Steve is familiar with his numerous reality shows. So lots of varied conversations here with Eric Young. They do talk a lot about wrestling too, about Eric's upbringing in Canada, training with Waldo Von Erich, as well as Eric's interest in comic books. So we're all over the place here on this episode. It's good stuff. All right, this day in Steve Austin history, today being March 7th, we're looking at 1992, Oakland, California. Dustin Rhodes, Rick, and Scott Steiner defeated WCW TV champion Steve Austin and WCW Tag Team Champions Arn Anderson and Bobby Eaton in an elimination match. Moving on to 1993 in Raleigh, North Carolina, WCW Tag Team Champions Steve Austin and Brian Pillman, the Hollywood Blondes, defeated Ricky Steamboat and Shane Douglas. That's right, the Hollywood Blondes did win the titles before last time I talked about this. I misspoke and said that the champions were still Steamboat and Douglas on the 5th, and that was not true. They did win them at a WCW Saturday Night taping, the Hollywood Blondes did, so here they are defending the titles against the former tag champs. And then we move on to the WWF in 1996, Tyler, Texas. Shawn Michaels defeated Steve Austin. This is often when Steve will talk about doing the J-O-B to Shawn Michaels numerous nights early on in his WWF tenure. Also in 1998 in Detroit, Michigan, Stone Cold Steve Austin defeated Triple H. And finally in 1999 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Steve Austin and Mankind defeated WWF World Champion The Rock and Kane in the Texas Tornado match. I got my information from thehistoryofwwe.com, and that is your day in Steve Austin history for March 7th. All right, coming up after the break, we're going to hear from Showtime Eric Young here on a classic episode of the Steve Austin Show.
There's one thing I know for certain. Experience the rush of a live event Whether it be your favorite band, sports team, or seeing your favorite WWE superstars in person is unrivaled. You owe it to yourself to get out of the house and get on the scene. Our new sponsor, Vivid Seats, is here to make those classic moments a reality. Vivid Seats is the top source for tickets for all the live events you want to go to. They make it easy for you, sorting by price and letting you look for seats in the section and row of your choice. To make things even better, Vivid Seats has given listeners of my show only an exclusive code for new customers to receive 10% off your first ticket order to save even more money. Just go to the App Store or the Google Play Store and download the Vivid Seats mobile app. First-time customers can use code STONECOLD for 10% off your first Vivid Seats order. Every purchase is backed by a 100% buyer guarantee, and Vivid Seats offers win insurance on your purchase of any playoff ticket. When you purchase tickets for a playoff game that does not take place, you will receive a full refund plus an additional 10% promotion code to use on any future order. From the biggest concerts and games to the hottest live events and more, Vivid Seats has it all. Download the app and enter code STONECOLD for 10% off your first order on Vivid Seats. Make a memory that lasts a lifetime with Vivid Seats, and that's the bottom line, because I said so.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
Eric, welcome to the show and welcome to my house.
Yeah, I can hard to believe I'm sitting in your house right now, man. It's pretty cool.
Don't have a flashback and go into a bunch of crazy shenanigans as would happen in a squared circle. No. Please promise me that.
Definitely not.
You know, before you got here, I was trying to think, how am I going to start this conversation off? Because you're an interesting cat. You come from the world of professional wrestling, and you're a youngster. You're only 33 years old.
Yep, young
enough. You've had 15 years in the business.
Yep.
And I was watching TNA before you got here, killing time, thinking. And then they ran a couple of promos for your reality television show on Animal Planet, Off the Hook Extreme Catches.
Yep.
And I said, man, let's start with the here and now, because that's why what you're out here in Los Angeles, California, pushing your show. Mm-hmm. You're traveling around. Tell me about the grind. And tell me right now, how in the hell did you land this show Off the Hook?
Well, I mean, you've been on set before. Wrestling is a grind on its own. But the world of television is a different kind of grind altogether, and probably more mentally grinding than anything I've done. It's long, long hours, tedious, you know, do it over, you know, take 45, it's tough, man, and making a fishing show is extra tough. As you know, you had a small conversation on the phone the other day. It is called fishing, not catching. So, you know, it's the increased pressures of catching this really hard stuff. But the show's super fun to make. The crew is great, and I'm having all these amazing experiences, but it can wear on you.
Yeah, but how did you land the gig? I mean, you come from the squared circle.
Yep.
All of a sudden, Animal Planet just call you up and say, Eric, we want you to catch fish and film you while you do it. How did that happen?
I want to say that that's how it happened, but how it happened is it's the age old story of it's who you know, a person that you've crossed paths with. I'm pretty sure Jesse Ward. She was on the first season of Tough Enough. She was the small little blonde girl that fell on her face.
Sweetheart.
Yeah, great girl. Me and her became pretty close. She was working in TNA for 4 or 5 years, and I helped her with some of her stuff from school. And we became really close, really good friends. She stopped there. She started working in film and TV, and she was doing freelance work with Animal Planet and working at a Boston production company called Powder House. The series producer, Dan Bree, of Off the Hook and Extreme Catches and her work together, she saw something come across Facebook or some casting call thing and said, you know, they're looking for a new host. He's got to be physical. He's got to be funny. And she said she thought of me right away. She called Dan Bree. A week later, Dan Bree called me. He said if it was his choice, I'd be the host. And a couple months after that, I got the gig.
Well, talk about being funny. You just have a great comedic timing. Were you a class clown growing up?
Yeah.
A jokester? Do you love stand-up comedy? What's the story?
I love stand-up comedy. I've never done it myself, but I love it. I respect the art of it, like the comedic timing. But I've always been a bit of a goofball. I like making people laugh. You know, more importantly, I like entertaining people, like wrestling and television. I never got into it to be famous or, you know, to be recognized. I got into it because I like to entertain people. And that's the number one reason. And I can do it in two different ways, wrestling and on television.
So is this, when is the season premiere of Extreme Catches?
It's Sunday, June 16th, 8 p.m. Eastern.
Sunday, June 16th.
Yep.
Okay. The second season, correct?
Number two. Yeah.
And obviously the first one performed outstanding. I saw a couple episodes, loved it. They filmed the shit out of that damn show. Yeah. I love the way they film it. But talk to us about going out and fishing is one thing.
Right.
And filming it's another. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they ain't biting.
Yep.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I'm making T-shirts. Mother Nature hates the world of production because she does. There's no doubt about it. If it's not rain, it's sun. If it's not sun, it's wind. If it's not wind, it's the fact that we're trying to catch a rare fish or we're trying to catch a very hard to catch fish in a very difficult way. Some of these guys have been doing this stuff for 20, 30 years. I've got to learn how to do it in 24 hours. And I'm not an expert fisherman. I'm a novice at best. You know, guys always joke about it. You know, I can barely cast. That's all well and good. The bait gets out there just the same. But yeah, I'm novice as far as it comes to fishing. I'm novice and the stuff I'm doing is very, 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 precise and very, very hard to learn how to do free diving. And I mean, none of the stuff I had ever done before. So I think that's why the show is kind of successful is, I'm asking questions that regular people ask because that's who I am in the fishing world. I'm just a regular guy that has never done any of this stuff before.
What's been the toughest thing that you guys have had to catch so far? And from just a productivity standpoint, you're out there trying to catch a sumbitch. It ain't biting. You need to have something for film for a show.
Tarpon. It's a difficult fish to catch. We actually didn't end up catching a tarpon. We were fishing for them in Puerto Rico, in the marshlands in Puerto Rico. And what's frustrating about catching tarpon is they come up to the surface to breathe. And so you can see them. You know that they're there. They're rolling and getting breath and coming up. And they're everywhere, thousands of them all over the place. But we were there for two straight days, about two 20-hour days back-to-back, paddling around these marsh and these kayaks trying to catch these tarpon. And we ended up not catching one. But the show's so strong, even without the catch, that Animal Planet didn't care. And that'll air this season two.
With the travel schedule mm-hmm. that you went through in professional wrestling, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit because you got 15 years worth. How does that compare to what you're doing now? How long are you guys gone for once you get on the road to try to knock down some episodes?
Well, I set an all-time best record this year for me personally. I left my house and then I returned to my house 48 days later. So I had 48 days straight from TV, wrestling TV, pay-per-view, fan fest. Then I flew to Alaska for 2 weeks, Minnesota for a week, Montreal for a week, and then back to Orlando for more wrestling, and then I went home. So it was 48 days straight without going home at all. I actually had my wife sending me bags of clothes and to different hotels where I was going to be and stuff. And on top of that, we were doing, I mean, it's the water, the weather's freezing. I went out on a boat in the Bering Sea. Then I was ice fishing in Minnesota. It's negative 20. And then I did free diving under the ice. And I'm one of 20 people, the guy figures, in the world that's ever free dove under the ice.
How was it?
It was amazing, man. It's
horseshit.
It really is.
Amazing.
It really is. It's, I mean, it looks like another world. Because you're under the
ice.
Yeah,
from that standpoint, but I mean from a chill factor standpoint. Talk to me about that. I mean, are you kidding me?
It's cold. I mean, they do very well of having the right equipment and stuff. We had 7 mil wetsuits, free dive wetsuits, which are the thickest ones you can get. So my core temperature, I'm a chubby Canadian, and I sweat thinking about it being hot, you know. So my core temperature stayed okay. We were only in the water for about an hour and a half at a time. And but your hands and your feet, I mean, they just get so unbearably cold. It feels like they're in a vice, you know, like, and trying to shoot a spear gun with giant neoprene mitts isn't the easiest thing I've ever done either.
I see a lot of the fishing shows, whether they're trying to catch crabs or lobsters or whatever the hell they're trying to catch. A lot mm-hmm. of dangerous stuff going on with some high seas, waves. And hey, dude, when you're out in the middle of nowhere in water on something that floats, mm-hmm. shit happens.
Yep.
What's the safety factor on your show? Any accidents? You still got all your digits and nothing's cut off?
Yeah, still got all the digits. It's it's extreme catches, you know. I'm in some hairy situations. We take all the precautions you can, but like you said, like, you know, the ocean doesn't care. it's unforgiving, and
it swallows up another sumbitch. It's just another day at the office.
That's right. It doesn't care, you know, how tough you are or how much weight you can lift or how far you can run. It doesn't matter any of that stuff. If it's you versus the ocean, you're losing every single time. I've learned that a few times during season two the hard way. I got thrown into rocks and, you know, near hypothermia, blue lips, cuts all over my hands. I had a Goliath grouper almost pull my middle finger off, and you got to have your middle finger.
Yeah, you
gotta have it.
You got to. Especially me.
Yeah, especially you. More
I was going to have mine insured by Lloyd's of London, but I couldn't afford it, so I went with Boyd's of Biloxi.
Yeah, hey, whoever's going to take the policy, it's all good. Boyd's of Biloxi, they came through.
So you get out there and you're in the middle of nowhere, and you know, you got cameras rolling and stuff like that, but shit happens. I mean, do you ever just say, what the fuck am I doing out here, or just go into a panic mode? I've never met you. I've watched you on TV at TNA for a couple of years and enjoyed your stuff. You strike me initially as a pretty cerebral cat. What happens when the shit goes down with you?
Yeah, I'm pretty relaxed, man. I don't get too worked up about anything. You know, it says in the open of the show that I'm an adrenaline junkie, and that's true. You know,
right.
That's part of the reason why I love pro wrestling. Like, you know, as you know, the rush of the crowd, or, you know, manipulating people to react when you want them to, and, you know, the highs and the lows and the roller coaster ride and all that stuff. I mean, I live for that. I live for that feeling. And, I mean, I'll probably chase it to the day I die. You know, when I was a kid, I was the kind of guy that, you know, I bet you can't climb that tree. Well, I'll show you. I'll climb that tree and then I'll jump off the top. That's just how I was. And I'm 33 now and still the same way. Anything to entertain people and anything to have that adrenaline rush definitely is definitely a thing. But I mean, I've sworn a few times, yelled at the directors and asked what the fuck we're doing out here. But that happens sometimes because it can get wild.
Okay, well, what's the wildest it's been? And I got a like a 6-part question. I'll keep it at one. So what's the wildest thing that's happened to you? And you said, what in the fuck am I doing out here? I got a wife and some dogs.
Yeah, the wildest for me was, it's actually during the season premiere. It's in Hawaii. It's a thing called Opihi picking. And I don't ask too many questions going into it because I don't want to know what I'm doing. I want to go in to it just how it appears on the show. You know, I'm meeting this guy for the first time. He shows me what we're doing, talks about it, and then we go do it. That's how it happens. That's what really goes on in the show. I know what kind of clothes to bring. I have a small feeling of what we're going to do and a small brief description. So Opihi picking is basically you got these specialized boots. You're walking around on some slippery rocks along the coastline picking shellfish with a butter knife. That's what it is. And when I first read it, I was like, man, that sounds...
Stop.
Yep.
Picking shellfish with a butter knife.
Yep. You got a butter knife in your hand.
Okay, why the butter knife?
They use the butter knife, one, because it's cheap and you can get them anywhere. And you got to pry them off the rocks.
Okay.
Because they're really stuck. They're like a shellfish, so they're like a suction cup on the rock. And if you touch them, they clamp down real hard. So you got to like go real quick with the butter knife and scrape them off before they know you're there. I mean, they can't see you. They got no eyes. But if you touch them, they clamp down real hard. You can't pull them off your hands.
Right.
Yeah. So I read that little description. I was like, man, that sounds kind of lame. You know, like it's supposed to be dangerous. It's supposed to be exciting, you know. And I got out there and I found out the hard way. It's Opihi, actually translated in Hawaiian, is fish of death. And it's called that because the Hawaiians say more people died doing that a year than actual the deadliest catch, which was in the Bering Sea. And I did that this season as well. But more people fish on cod boats and on crab boats than do Opihi picking. So they say, you know, several people die doing it every single year.
Well, how are these people dying if they're walking on some slippery rocks with a butter knife?
Mm-hmm.
How are they dying?
Well, they're dying because at the same time you've been in the ocean, you don't get to turn the waves off. And as the tide's coming in, the waves are getting taller and taller. And it's basically the wave, then you, and then rock cliffs. And even when you see him coming, there's a shot in the show where Kaleo, the guy I'm with, says, here comes a big one. And I've got my foot under a rock, my left arm's around a rock, my right arm's back against the cliff, and my right foot's back against the cliff. And it hits me, and it throws me so hard against this cliff. I got cuts all over my arms from the coral. I got fire coral on my right arm. I've gotten bleeding out of both of my arms. I got a cut on the side of my face. Back's all cut up. Knees are cut up. And knocks my hat off, shirts up over my head. I mean, it, and that was what the fuck, kind of, what are we doing here kind of moment.
So, but basically, people out there, and at least in this instance, it sounds like you can be beaten to death.
Beaten to death, yeah. Bludgeoned, hit your head on a rock, drowned, you know, drug out to sea. And a lot of these guys do it by themselves. You know, we're there, I'm there with a cameraman, you know, there's a safety diver, there's all this stuff. The worst that's going to happen to me is I'm going to, you know, maybe get knocked unconscious or, you know, get bloodied a little bit, and all that happened. But this guy, Kaleo, he normally walks to these places and does it by himself. And the first thing he said when we got there, he said, if I came all this way by myself today, I wouldn't even have picked because the waves were too high. But production schedule says get down there.
When you got to turn in a show, mister, you got to turn in a show.
That's right.
When the pressure's on. Like you said, sometimes when the fish ain't biting or those waves are coming too high on the picking session here, you got to do what you got to do. And sometimes the results ain't so good. I got to ask you, You've been spending a lot of time in the water. As you can see over my right shoulder, I have a big 6-foot shark.
Yep.
Red with flames on it.
Yep.
I love sharks.
Yeah.
But they scare the living shit out of me.
Yep.
I did a research paper on sharks. It was my first research paper I ever did. You had any close encounters yet?
Yeah, we've had a bunch of close encounters. We did a free diving episode from Puerto Rico this year. We went with a guy, Roberto Reyes is his name, tiny little Puerto Rican cat. He holds 12 world records for free dive spearfishing. I think he's got gills behind his ears. Dude can literally hold his breath forever, man, like forever.
Crazy.
And I've only free dove, I guess now it'll be 5 times in my life, and I actually set my personal best of 70 feet this year in Hawaii, and that's a long ways.
That's a long way down,
yeah,
mister.
That's
bottom of a bathtub is long enough for me.
Yeah, it's on one breath, and coming up is always the hard part, getting down that far. But Roberto Reyes from Puerto Rico, he says we're going to go to a top of an underwater volcano, and we drift dive across the top of the underwater volcano because that's where all the fish hang out. So he goes, we will see sharks today. It's like, okay, you know, what kind? He's like, mostly reef sharks, you know, they won't bother us, but, you know, probably tiger sharks too. And like I said, I'm a novice fisherman. You know, I know a lot about fishing and marine life from proxy, from being around the show, doing all this stuff for 2 years. I know that tiger sharks can be aggressive. They're in the top probably 15% of the more aggressive kind of sharks. So we get there, we're diving, and we see a reef shark, about a 6-foot reef shark. And I've never been in the water and seen a shark. I've seen them from the boat, and I've seen them in an aquarium, but I've got a pair of fins on. I'm floating on top of the water, breathing up, getting ready to dive down with this great big 6-foot spear gun. And I see this shark swimming along. I mean, that's a cool experience to be in the water and see it. It's not even looking at us, just cruising along the bottom, eating stuff off the bottom. Then I feel Roberto pat me on the arm, and he's doing the, you know, hand on the top of the
shark sign,
yeah. International shark sign. And he points over, and there's a 13-foot tiger shark swimming straight up our chum line. And so we start swimming towards it because I want to get a shot of me over the shoulder of me and the shark.
You got a 13-foot tiger shark swimming towards you, and you're swimming towards it?
I'm swimming towards it. And I think that's where stupidity takes over at that point.
Hey, that or a lot of adrenaline, mister.
Yeah, it's adrenaline
so
and stupidity.
Happens? What happens?
So we start swimming towards it, and as we're swimming towards it, it's swimming straight up, and it banks to the right, and we're to the right. And now the thing, I know their eyes are on the side of their head, but it's staring straight at me. It stops. We stop. It's sitting there. I mean, it seemed like 20 minutes where this 13-foot shark is looking at us, shooting the guy's underwater camera guy's shooting over my shoulder, and you'll see it in the show. It's literally 10 feet away from me, 13-foot tiger shark, and then it just turns and takes off. I'll never forget that as long as I live.
I tell you what, I live a mile from the Pacific Ocean right here, here in L.A., and I stay away from that damn place. I'm a brave motherfucker. You get a damn shark on land, yeah, I'll whoop that sumbitch's ass, but once you put that thing back in water, not so much.
Yeah, that's not our home turf, that's for sure.
It is not. When you guys are out there,
yep,
and coming from just a production and some of the reality experience that I've had, what is your production team? How many guys or gals y'all taking out in the field? What kind of crew you got?
Usually on the crew, there's a director. There's one sound guy.
Now, let's talk about the director.
Let's talk about it.
Because if you're thinking about a movie,
Mm-hmm.
This motherfucker says, action, and shit happens.
Yep.
What does the director do on your set?
Well, the director is, in a show like this, he's a decision maker. He's, they've got a story. The Off the Hook, Extreme Catches, it's a television show first. It's, it is a type of reality show. It's a hosted reality show, but it's a television show first. And like you said, like you got to deliver on the goods. And what makes good television is good stories. So the story is chubby Canadian with a beard shows up to some place where he doesn't know where he is. He meets a guy that's an expert at doing something. That guy talks about it. Eric learns how to do it. Eric fails. Eric learns how to do it some more. Eric succeeds. Everyone's happy. Everyone drinks beers. That's the basic story, but they're always different. So he's there to make the decisions on, what we need next, fill in footage. This is the part of the show where we're going into the break. We want it to be exciting. It's a television show first. All the stuff we're doing is happening. I've spent hours, countless hours fishing and waiting and stuff like that. All that stuff is taken out for your enjoyment because you don't want to see me sitting there.
But that's half of what everything is in television these days. I mean, just from football into the pro wrestling game, which we're going to get to here in a minute. Matches happen faster. They're edited tighter. If they're going to wrestle through two breaks, they're going to, end up on a good spot, maybe a double down, cut to commercial, coming back, both guys coming up. There's that excitement you're talking about just to leave some interest. Goddamn, I can't wait for this commercial to be over so I can see what the hell Eric's doing. Did that 13-foot tiger shark get his ass or not?
That's right. Don't want him switching the channel.
But total bodies, total cameras. How many people?
One camera, one underwater camera, one sound, one producer, and then usually a PA, which is usually just the guy that carries stuff, basically, and buys sandwiches.
Where are you guys staying? Just
everywhere. I mean, we've stayed in everywhere from Marriott's to Captain's Lodge Fishing Village, in the middle of nowhere. And as your body doesn't, go on hold. So my days sometimes can start at 2-3 in the morning. People that follow me on Twitter will know that, there's been mornings I'm awake at 2 a.m. so I can drive an hour to the closest gym, get a workout in, and drive back, shower, and eat before all the rest of the guys are even awake.
And I wanted to ask you about your workout schedule because you put together Cat. You're obviously in great shape. How are you able to maintain your physical fitness doing this reality show? Because, you guys are on the go in the elements. It ain't like you got a bunch of weights hanging around.
Yeah.
And it's a different ball game from the pro wrestling game where you know where all the gyms are at.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not in cities where there's a Golds to choose from or a Curves for someone like me. That's where I like to go.
Yeah.
Okay, I like to get my workouts in at Curves. It's a skill you learn from pro wrestling, gym finding. Sometimes they'll help look for me. The production company will help find one for me close or whatever. But a lot of times I do it myself. I figure out where to go and what to do. And I ask them, when do you need me ready to go? They say, okay, well, we're going to be at the boat at 6. We're leaving here at 5. Well, if I got to leave at 5 a.m., I know the gym's an hour. I got to get up at 2. Drive to the gym, get there at 3, work out for an hour, 4, come back, get back at 5, shower real quick, grab something to eat, and then meet the guys and head out. So it's a schedule thing, man.
So who's prepping all your meals for you?
I'm prepping them myself most of the time.
A lot of PB&J, ham and cheese?
Oh, yeah, a lot of PB&J, a lot of Waffle House, a lot of IHOP, a lot of breakfast places, 24-hour breakfast places. So as you know, it's a road favorite.
Oh, yeah, especially if you're in Texas, or to the southeast, when you're talking Waffle Houses and stuff like that. But you guys are going to all these crazy locations where you're not going to find that.
Yeah.
And, mister, if you're out in the elements and all of a sudden you're running low on fuel and you ain't got no, when I say fuel, I'm talking about food, and you ain't got nothing to eat, and you're trying to be all pleasant and professional on camera, and you got a bunch of UVA, UVB rays beating the shit out of you from the sky in the form of a sun, and you're getting your ass blistered, and you're hungry, and you're trying to produce, that makes up for a real tough day.
Yeah, it's easily the hardest thing I've done, making this show.
I hear a lot of these people out here in Los Angeles have these crazy riders where, in their little dish when you go to the show, they can have all the M&Ms, but they can't have some green ones, and they want some sparkling water and all this other bullshit or some pink tissues. I don't imagine you have that.
No, I mean, I'm not to that level yet. It's just a matter of
but
time.
You don't strike me as that kind of person anyway. You seem like a low-maintenance kind of guy. If you give your ass a piece of meat and a potato or something like that, you're going to go out there and work your ass off.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. They treat me well there at Animal Planet, the production company, Part 2 Pictures. They're great, and it's they take care of me pretty good. So
you like this world, don't you?
It's been an amazing experience, man. It's crazy long hours. It's crazy hard work, but it's probably the most rewarding experience of my life.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
March Madness is upon us, and Dan Patrick has you covered.
I probably wouldn't do the hat because I don't want to mess up the hair.
Join Dan and the Danettes as they keep up with every twist and turn in the NCAA tournament on The Dan Patrick Show. Every day, hear the hottest takes and the biggest celebrity interviews from the world of sports and entertainment.
He's as cocky and confident as Baker Mayfield is.
Don't miss the madness on The Dan Patrick Show, right here on Podcast One.
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
I was doing my research on you, Eric, and noticed that you've been in the ring for quite some time.
Yeah.
You grew up, you're Canadian.
Yep.
We talked a little bit earlier before we started rolling these microphones, and your athletic background, you played rugby and soccer.
Yep.
Two sports that here in America where football is king.
Yep.
And anywhere else on the planet, soccer and rugby is the shit. I mean, that's what everybody hangs their hat on.
Yeah.
And what else did you play?
I played everything. I mostly baseball when I was a younger kid. I grew up in Canada, so I played hockey. I could skate pretty much from the...
You still follow a hockey game?
I still follow hockey. I got
Who's
this,
your favorite team?
I got this cut on my nose playing open hockey in Tennessee just before the media tour, so Animal Planet was pretty happy about that.
It's not going to ruin your modeling career. Don't worry about it.
No, I ain't getting any uglier. I didn't get stitches. So, I follow the Nashville Predators and the Toronto Maple Leafs. They're my first love in hockey, so I'll always be a Maple Leafs fan, but also a Nashville Predators fan. Follow hockey. Stanley Cup playoffs right now are awesome. But I'm a huge football guy, too.
What's your team?
Tennessee Titans.
You say that because you live in Nashville?
I live in Nashville, but it's a funny thing. I actually was a Tennessee Titans fan before that. Loved Steve McNair. Loved Eddie Jord. Loved Yancey Thigpen, Steve Mason. I mean, all these guys. Derek Mason. I mean, I loved them all. Keith Bullock. I mean, I was, when I played football for, on Madden 92, 93, that's who I was. I was the Tennessee Titans. And, then I ended up moving there in 2004. Still love them to this day. Football's football. I'll watch anything. I'll watch Seahawks versus the Cardinals. I don't care. I'll watch it.
How in the hell did you end up in Nashville, Tennessee, if you're from Canada?
I ended up there for pro wrestling. I had a wrestling school in Canada and a full-time job and a house, and I was having troubles getting across, and I had a bunch of tryouts with the WWF and WWE and a couple of tryouts with TNA, and I know that they were kind of looking at me, and I just wanted to make it real easy for them. So I gave my house to my friend, quit my job, put my wrestling stuff and some clothes in my car and drove down to Nashville. 2 weeks later, I had a job, and I've had one ever since.
Did wrestling mean that much to you?
It did. Still does. Yeah. From the age of 17 to 26, I think I was hired when I was 26. I mean, it was every second of every day with pro wrestling.
What is your first memory of professional wrestling?
My first memory was WrestleMania 3, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, and Macho Man Randy Savage. I grew up just across from Detroit, and I was there. I saw it, and I was in the nosebleeds. I was so high up at the Silverdome, I couldn't tell who was coming out to the ring unless I listened to their music. That's one of my first, and my dad used to sneak me into old bars and hotels in Canada, and they would play the pay-per-views, and I'd be cross-legged on the floor in front of the TV, and all these drunk maniac Canadians yelling all around me, I remember being in love with it when I was 5 years old.
What was it about the business as you fell in love with it when you did, but when you decided that was what you must do, what was the thing that just said, hey, this is it, or that passion or your love for the business?
I think it was just like the characters, and I think at the time when I was so young, but it was the storytelling is what it was for me is like how vested as a kid I was. I mean, when I'm a kid, I wasn't looking at it like that, but I think that's what it was, like the story of, you know, Macho Man, and he had Elizabeth, and, you know, George Ann was still, he liked Elizabeth, and he was with Ricky, and like all these, I mean, and they took their time and told these crazy, amazing, elaborate stories that were unfolding in front of my eyes. And it wasn't told so much with words, it was told with physical action. And that's another thing that was always a huge part of my life, sport. So it was, you know, the two combination of entertainment and sport into one. I mean, it's a match made in heaven for me.
So you decided to get in the pro wrestling game.
Had to do it.
Straight out of high school?
Yeah, right out of high school. A week after high school, I was at a wrestling gym training full time.
Now, how do you go about searching for someone in that neck of the woods? Because Waldo Von Erich trained you.
Yeah.
How do you go searching this cat out? Is there a competition? Did you have other choices?
I did, yeah. I looked around. Scott D'Amore had a wrestling school at the time, and I actually got talked to Scott. We ended up becoming really good friends, and he helped get my job at TNA, and is still a great friend of mine to this day. He was closing his school, and the Hearts in Calgary was a long ways for me to go, but they weren't even really running the gym at the time. I talked to Al Snow in Lima, Ohio, had a gym, Monster Factory out of New Jersey where Bam Bam trained. I talked to them. I talked to Offa, actually. He had a wrestling school there that Samu ran, and I talked to him a little bit, and he actually helped break me into the United States. Samu, a guy I talked to and I stayed in touch with, and he came up to Canada and ran some shows, and I introduced myself, and he remembered talking to me on the phone when I was a 17-year-old kid about coming down to his school. But I ended up settling on a spin-off of the Hart Brothers in Cambridge, Ontario. Waldo Von Erich was the main trainer, and he was really old at the time. Great guy, though.
That's what I was wondering about, because when I was doing my research, I know this cat, you know, Waldo died at 75.
Yep.
But while you were coming through there, he was probably in his mid to late 60s.
Yep.
So what was his activity in the ring with you? Was it more from a coaching standpoint, dropping psychology on you?
Yeah, it was more from outside of the ring. He would get in the ring every now and then. You could see he still had the hitch. You know, I mean, he wanted to come in and physically show you how to do it, but he was pretty beat up. He was an older guy, and he had really bad back problems from wrestling and traveling so much and doing that whole thing. But the psychology part, you know, in storytelling and that, the ability to portray a character, that here's a guy that's, you know, he's a Canadian guy, born and raised in Canada, Canadian German heritage. He was called Cheetah Man. He was he broke in California as Cheetah Man. He wore a mask. Then he moved to New York and wrestled for the WWE, and they put this Nazi gimmick on him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Canadian living in the United States, playing a Nazi, and wrestled Bruno Sammartino, and he had some wild stories, man. But learning the psychology and storytelling and characterization from him, you know, it's second to none.
Well, you know, here's a guy, you're sitting there trying to learn a trade, you want to go into business of pro wrestling, you can see that this guy's beat to shreds. He has a bad back. It has taken its toll on him. You can see years down the road, this might be where you might end up.
That's right.
So what'd you think about that?
I didn't let it affect me. It did cross my mind, you know, and you always hear stuff and you see stuff, and, you know, the older guy saying, you know, take care of yourself. And I've tried to do that. There's no way to get out of this business unscathed. It's not a possibility. I can't straighten my right arm. I broke my ankle and couldn't afford to fix it. I wrestled 2 days later on a TNA pay-per-view with a broken ankle. I wrestled Dusty Rhodes on a TNA pay-per-view with a broken ankle. I've broken all my fingers. I've broken my wrist. But I consider myself pretty lucky. I'm pretty low on the list as far as injuries goes for being a guy that's been doing it since I was 17.
You're a young cat. You're 33 years old. Morning comes up. It's 3 in the morning. You're going to go get a gym before you go catch fish for a TV show. Is it hard to get out of bed?
Not yet, actually. I'm lucky that way. I have kind of a weird thing where I believe I was physically made to do it. I've actually have an abnormally large bone structure for someone my age, and someone my height. I did a physical testing thing in Canada when I was younger, and they test the density and the thickness of my bones, and my bones are thick like somebody that's 6'4".
Like a motherfucking caveman? You saying?
Yeah, I'm a mutant.
We were talking earlier about gym stuff and your fitness regimen and how you stayed in shape on the road, and you said, you told me that if you used to walk in the gym today, you could lay down after a warm-up on a bench and press 315 pounds 20 times.
I'm going to say 10 for sure because I haven't done heavyweights in a long time.
20 is a whole lot different from 10.
You're right. You're
but
right.
That being said, that 10 being reps said, 315 is still an ass load of weight and an ass load of reps.
Yeah, for a guy that's, you know, 5'10", right. 225, 230. Yeah. Yeah, I've got the short bust strength, Steve. I've always had it. And I heard that your podcast with Kevin Nash, great friend of mine, actually tag champs with Kev and stuff back when he was working with TNA. I don't even work my legs. I have crazy tree stump legs. Don't even do squats.
Like
do
I always
press.
Tell the Ravishing Rick Rude story. He always fuck steak, Steve. It's an upper body business. That's what he always
There's
said.
A lot of truth to that. There's a lot of truth to that. But I think I'm, you know, having my thick legs and thick core is another reason why I don't get hurt. I just don't, you know, knock on wood. I was designed to do it. When I was 3 years old, I had a blood disease called purpura, where all your white blood cells die and you become really susceptible to clotting. If someone touches you, you get a bruise. And I mean, I obviously lived through that. But when you live through that, your body becomes less susceptible to clotting and less susceptible to bruising. So I'm basically just like a really shitty version of Wolverine.
We got Wolverine on a budget right here at the Austin Crib.
Walmart Wolverine.
So you're back at the wrestling school.
Yep.
And you love wrestling.
I do.
You were up there at the top row watching Ricky the Dragon Steamboat and Randy Macho Man Savage in a classic in WrestleMania 3. You want to be a wrestler. You find out, search out Waldo Von Erich. You go in the ring. All of a sudden, y'all start taking bumps. Somebody slams you. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
The first time I fell in an actual pro wrestling ring, there is not a person alive that does this for a living that took the fall for the first time and didn't say, what the fuck? Where's the spring at?
You know? Yeah, where's that fucking spring you always talk about when they say it's fake?
Pull the apron up and take a look underneath. Where's the springs at?
Hey, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely what went through my mind. And, you know, I was the guy that at the wrestling school, we were allowed to be in the ring at 5:30 and we had to be out of the ring. So it was right beside a bunch of apartments at 11. At 5:30 on the dot, I crawled through the ropes. At 11, they would have to come in and get me out of the ring every single day, 7 days a week.
Before you came over, I was watching a match you had with a young man named Austin Aries from TNA.
Great
a hell of a match. He's a very good, accomplished guy in the ring.
Yep.
Hell of a match. You unfortunately did the favors and that one. You were looking up the lights for a three count.
Yep.
But you're very technically proficient. How fast or how long did it take you to catch on to the game? Just as far as, you know, chain wrestling, you know, learning the moves, moving through transitions. Did you adapt pretty quick?
Yeah, I learned super quick. And this is, it's a rare thing, but I did backyard wrestling when I was a kid. But it was we didn't wrestle in the grass in my backyard. We actually built a ring out of an old trampoline, and my dad had a friend that was a welder and welded poles. We had it was a six-sided ring with six poles, and we had turnbuckles and ropes and the whole thing. So a lot of the stuff I could kind of do. A lot of the moves I could already kind of do. And so I learned really quick. I had my first match about 2.5 months into training, which is, as you know, it's pretty rare to have your first match right away like that. And but it was learning the little nuances that took me a little bit longer.
How soon or how long did it take for Waldo to smarten you guys up and let you know the business was a work? I know when you came in, it was a little bit more of a different game than when I was around. But how long did it take for that guy to smarten you up? Was it day one?
Yeah, it was day one there. We did, it was hard training though. We ran stairs. We did, 500 leg lifts. We did, 200 crunches, 100 push-ups. And that was every day. Every day at the gym, you do 30 flights up and down, 15 both way. It was a big set of stairs. It was a wrestling gym that was upstairs. We would start the day off amateur wrestling, and a guy that never did any amateur wrestling, I was lost. And like, there was two guys from Iran there, and we're both wrestlers in high school. And the one guy had tried out for the Iranian Olympic team, and I mean, they just ate us up. They were terrible pro wrestlers, but and any chance I got in with him because I wanted to learn. I was terrible, but I was always very athletic and strong. So, I could hold my own. I would never win because I didn't know anything about amateur wrestling. And we never had it in my high school. So I didn't know anything about it. But it was an awesome, awesome training experience. Amazing training experience.
You've been in the business 15 years. with being in that time, what is your grasp on psychology from a heel standpoint versus babyface standpoint? Which do you prefer? Which is easier for you?
I think easier for me. I've mostly been a babyface. Mostly a babyface. I like being a heel. I think because it's a bit of a stretch for me. It's harder for me. I think nowadays it's harder to be a babyface. It takes a lot more skill because if you go so far the one way, back in the day, 80s, 90s, you just had to like smile and shake your fist and clap a couple hands and you were the good guy. I think that's changed. Wrestling fans seem to be more smart to the business now, and it's a lot more difficult to have everyone like you.
Yeah, and if you're a heel and you're somewhat cool, they'll start wanting you to turn babyface.
Yep, right away.
And some guys are, and your run as a heel with as much heat as you had at the highest point, were you ever afraid of heat?
No, definitely not afraid of you.
And let me explain that, because I'm getting new listeners jump on this show all the time.
Yep.
My hardcore listeners know what heat is. And when I'm talking heat, I'm talking about when those fans hate you as a heel, as the bad guy, you were trying to be hated. You were trying to do everything within your power to be hated by everybody in the world. Some people are uncomfortable with that because that's going to reflect on them in their personal life, or they kind of mark out and can't walk that line.
Yep.
Did that ever bother you?
No. I want that. When I was a heel, on TV, I have only been a heel, for very brief times in my TV wrestling life. But, I wanted that. I wanted people to hate me. I wanted them to not want to be around me, or not want my autograph, or not even watch me wrestle, or if the only reason they wanted to watch me wrestle is to get beat up, because that's to me what a heel's supposed to be. It's harder now. It's tough to have that real heat, I find, it's almost like you almost have to be boring, or not interesting.
Well, I think it's it can still be done. I think it is tougher just because people know what the business is all about.
Yep.
So they're coming from a real educated standpoint, but that's the way everything evolves,
that's
the game that they're used to. So, they have evolved with the game. They get it. They know that there's a bad guy. They know that there's a good guy. In 2004, you showed up in WWE briefly.
Mm-hmm.
How many matches did you have? You did a couple of JOBs and then went on down to TNA.
Yeah. I did probably about 20, 25 matches with them, mostly darks. Did a couple things on heat, couple things on velocity at the time. I actually did, at one point I did 9 Monday, Tuesday runs in a row, and people thought I worked there. A guy that I knew from Canada, Rene Dupree, was there at the time.
Yeah,
he was like, oh, congratulations, man. And I was like, on what? And he's like, oh, well, you're working here now. And I was like, I'm not working here. I'm driving my aunt's Intrepid that's got no radio by myself all over the place. I was driving with the trucks, and everyone else was flying and going home. And I was just staying in the United States and staying in Motel 6s or sleeping in my car. And I did actually 8 weeks in a row with the WWE, not under contract. I got on every single time. Everyone liked me, and Sarge really liked me.
Sarge is great.
Yeah, great
guy. The one and only Hall of Famer, Sergeant Slaughter.
Yeah, he would make sure that I got on. So he knew that I was driving, I think, and made sure that I got paid one way or another. That time of my life in wrestling, I wouldn't trade for anything.
That's some of the best shit. Because back in the day when I was, my days in USWA when I was starving, eating potatoes, there you are, 8 weeks on the road in a Dodge Intrepid. What the fuck were you thinking? Hey, I hit the big time, or what does it take to hit the big time, or I'm paying my dues, what?
Yeah, well, the truth was, I was happier than a pig in shit, because I was making, they were paying us, I think it was $250 per show. That's 500 American. I drive that back to Canada at the time. That's $750. That's more than I was making working for a living. So I was happy about it, man. Just driving, and tough to have enough calories and protein during the day and the meals, but it was awesome, man. I wouldn't change it for anything.
You went to TNA in 2004.
Yep, 2004 was when I first started.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
When did that company start up?
I want to say it was end of 2002, early 2003. So it was only around for, you know, year, year and a half before I got there.
So how has it changed from when you went in to what it is now?
Well, when I got there, all they were doing pay-per-view only. They were doing Wednesday pay-per-views out of basically, I'm sure you've wrestled there, the fairgrounds in Nashville.
Oh,
it's a lot of luxury.
What a building, man. But you know, shit, that was a great building for wrestling.
Still there. Yeah. Still a great building. I watched Superstar Bill Dundee and Jerry Lawler wrestle on a show about a year and a half ago, and it was awesome.
Superstar Bill Dundee needs to be in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion.
Yeah.
That's what I think about the superstar.
Yep. He looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
Wrestles exactly the same. They didn't do a damn thing, and it was amazing. The building was completely packed because they were talking about tearing it down. So a lot of people showed up to that show. A young guy there, a young promoter there in Nashville put it on and had a hell of a show. But it's all the shows were shot in that building, you know, this tin shed in the middle of the fairgrounds. And then they signed on with Fox Sports. We started doing Thursday shows, so we would do Wednesday pay-per-views there, and then we would all fly down Wednesday or Thursday morning, tape Thursday afternoon, and then that show would air Friday on Fox Sports. So it was like a live to tape kind of thing.
Right.
Then they went from Fox Sports on to Spike TV, and they're still there. And now they moved to where they're doing the shows on the road, which is another step in the right direction. You know, business wise, I think they're doing it right. They're not getting too big for their britches too quick, and you know, baby steps, making their way.
You go into work, you've been filming your reality show Off the Hook,
mm-hmm.
and I'm talking to Showtime Eric Young on Twitter. What's the political landscape like? Do you walk into that place and you think, oh, shit, it's a clusterfuck? Or are you thinking, oh, shit, I'm glad to be at work. We're at TNA, and it's a good day, and we're going to have a good TV.
Yeah, it's pro wrestling. So, you know, every day.
Basically, it's everything I just said.
Yeah, everything can be a bit of a clusterfuck. So
yeah.
It's, you know, that's how the world goes. And the guys in the production world in reality TV, they don't understand how that can be, you know, and they're like, well, what shows are you on coming up? I'm like, I don't know. You know, they don't have them written yet. Well, you know, it airs next week. Well, they don't have it written. You know, so-and-so got hurt, and this guy's probably not going to be there because his contract's up. So, you know, I try not to get too involved in that stuff. I show up, and they give me what they want me to do, and I do that as best as I can and have the best time doing it. So that's how I've always been, and that's how I'll always be.
They've got a good roster put together.
Super good
They've
roster.
Got some pretty decent storylines going. I watch a show, and I'll go ahead and put this out there right now because I know I'm going to hear about it. Oh, I can't believe people call me Stone Cold. I can't believe Stone Cold said he watched TNA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're damn right I do. I watch Monday Night Raw too. I'm a pro wrestling fan. It's what I did for 15 years, and I still watch the product. I don't give a shit whose company it is. I like what happens in a squared circle, so I watch it.
Mm-hmm.
But they got a good roster put together.
Yeah.
Looking 5 to 10 years in the future, TNA still there?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a guy that, you know, like, you know, a year in, I thought, ooh, man, they kind of threw a bunch of money at a bunch of guys, you know, guys that weren't working for the WWE at the time or WCW, and a lot of problem childs, you know, a lot of projects, if you will, and they threw a lot of money. They spent a lot of money when they first started. But they learn, you know, they took their lumps and I mean, you still hear it every week. Oh, TNA's done. They're not going to be around. Well, they're still there. And this is 10 years later. And, you know, you hear that every week. They just signed a massive TV, 5-year TV deal with Spike TV. You know, gets, you know, one of the highest rated, if not the highest rated on show on Spike TV every week, seen in 120 countries around the world. You know, very solid ratings, you know, decent attendance on house shows every single weekend, merchandise sales, really good ratings in the UK, seen all over the world. It's, you know, it's, I think as far as pro wrestling goes, TNA's going to be there.
You came up with some of the most interesting gimmicks I've seen in a while, highly effective. What was with the paranoia or the Super Eric or the mentally challenged Eric? What was the story? Were these had to come out of your head.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff that went on came out of my head. We were talking earlier, Dutch Mantel. A lot of that I owed to Dutch, a guy that I talked to a lot. He lived just outside of Nashville, and I would see him a lot, and he liked me right away. I think he kind of like wanted to take me under his wing, and learned a lot from Dutch, as you know, as you did as well. Super smart guy. I mean,
Very smart.
He's Dutch. You know, he's definitely Dutch, but a great guy, and I learned tons from him. And the first 2 years I was in TNA, I was Team Canada Eric Young, and actually, you can go back from 2004 almost all the way to 2006. I didn't say one word, not one promo. I was in a bunch of promos, but I would just stand there. I was the wrestler. That's what I did. I towed the line and did the tag thing and won that with Bobby Roode and with Petey Williams and Johnny Devine as well. That was my job. I was the wrestler. I was the guy that carried the physical part of the matches. I didn't talk. I just went out and wrestled. That's what I did. But I kept begging him. I was like, just, for me, for myself, what I think my skill is in pro wrestling is portraying a character. And I said, I don't care what it is. You know what I mean? I'll be the donkey fucker. I don't care. Like, just give me a character. That's what I do. I tell stories and I play characters. That's who I am. And, Dutch pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And finally he got it. He got his chance. And he said, we want you to be paranoid, you know, and kind of worried all the time. And he's like, I did this storyline in Puerto Rico with Miguel Perez, and where he was kind of weird and afraid of everything and nervous. And he said, I want you to kind of do a version of that. So I just said, yep. And the very first thing we ever did with that was this thing with the Dudleys when they first came in, and America's Most Wanted were there, the tag champs, and it's a funeral scene, and I'm in one of the pews, and we're doing all this crazy stuff, it took us almost all night to do this thing because I kept cracking everybody up because the first time I'd ever done anything or shown any personality, and so I just ran with it, and the falling, the pyro would go off and it would scare me and fall down. I mean, you've heard pyro's loud, man, especially when in the building. I mean, if you're not ready for it, it can scare you.
You can be a real over baby face and pyro can go off, scared the shit out of you. You look like a real asshole.
Right. Yeah. So I just, I took that, and just every time the pyro would go off for 4 years, I would fall down on the ramp and hold my heart. And you can go back and watch the tape. I didn't lock up with the guy for 4 years. I did not. I refused to lock up. As Emily said, I said, I didn't even want to wear wrestling tights, because if I'm supposed to be scared of everything, then I shouldn't want to wrestle anybody, you know. I think it was just a way of, trying to get paid without having to do anything. But that was a really fun character, we did that, and then I did the super.
But how
thing.
Much did it take you to put into that character? Because it's from just you explaining it to watch you move your arms around and you're into it.
Yeah.
It seems like it was supernatural for you to do that.
It was, yeah. It's,
did you research paranoia?
No, I mean, I didn't. I just what I try to do, like when each time they would give me a character or a gimmick, I try to wrestle that way. I try to be, when the camera's on, that's who I am. I'm not Eric Young. I'm not, regular Eric Young. I'm not the guy that's in the back. I'm not the guy that rides in the van with my buddies. I'm not the guy that's at home with my dogs. I'm paranoid. And if I'm supposed to be paranoid, then that needs to be reflected in everything I do. I can't be paranoid when I come out and then the bell rings and I start kicking a guy's ass all over the ring. That to me doesn't make any sense. And, a lot of people will say, and I'll be the person, sometimes, I can be my own worst enemy, because people don't want to watch a guy not lock up and stuff. But that's just what I believe in pro wrestling. That character comes first, story comes first.
No, I dig what you're saying. I'm sitting there watching your eyes as we talk, but that commitment to character.
Yeah.
What guys screw up these days is committing halfway.
Yep.
Because when you can see fear or doubt in someone's eyes,
yep,
then you know that that's not real.
Yep.
And so many times, and this even transitions into promos, so many times I see cats do promos, and I can see right through them. They don't mean a goddamn word they're saying. They don't even know what they're saying. They're just saying something because someone told them to say it.
Yep.
But maybe I know for a fact, that's what grabbed me about your pre-tapes or your skits and stuff you did for the show was, this motherfucker, he's there.
Yeah.
He's real.
Yep. If I was paranoid, I was paranoid, like you said, and you can see it in my eyes. Like I would change the way I stood. I would change the way I moved. I would change the way I held my arms. I would change the way I reacted with people and talked with people. I would never like look them in the eye. It was always off to the side. That's something that someone that's paranoid or not confrontational, that's what they do. I'm not going to pretend like I'm scared on the ramp and then the bell rings and I go running across the the ring and started beating him all over the place because that's not who I'm supposed to be. To me, that character, though, I mean, he was the ultimate babyface piece. People just felt bad for him. The sympathy, you know, like the shine spots for me at that time, you know, during that era, the paranoid era, shine spots were me running away from the guy and doing funny stuff to stay away from him. They would cheer and laugh a little bit. And then, you know, I'd let them do that a little bit. Then he would beat me up for 8-10 minutes because that's what made sense to me.
And then the manic comeback.
And then the maniac comeback. Yeah.
Where did the Super Eric come from?
I'm a comic guy. Huge comic nerd.
Are you? What's your favorite comic book character?
I mean, Wolverine is way up there.
Are you a collector?
Yeah, I collect them. I have a stack beside my bed taller than me right now that's been waiting to be read.
You got a stack of comic books beside your bed.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of people with a stack of magazines beside their bed and comic books.
I keep those other ones in a special drawer.
Personal question. What's the most you paid for a comic book?
The most I've paid? I don't collect old ones, but I do have a Punisher 3. The third Punisher ever written. And I don't know what it's worth now, but a few years ago it was worth I think it was like $125. It was going into things. I don't know who you sell those to. I mean, I'm sure you put them up on eBay and you get collectors and stuff. But I don't know. I've always collected things and I was always really into comics, but they're very expensive. You know,
what else do you collect then?
Hockey cards, baseball cards. When I was a kid, I had piles of them. I mean, I still have them. Yeah. They're in my mother's house back in Canada. And I have a bunch of the really high end ones at my house in Nashville. I have a Bobby Orr Team Canada card. I have a bunch of really rare stuff that I collected over the years, but it was never about what it's worth to me. It was just I like having rare stuff. And the comic books, I just like the stories.
It was purely stories. I mean, it wasn't like you were living vicariously through the characters.
No.
You just like the stories. That seems kind of be going an ongoing thing with you.
Yeah.
You like stories and how they're carried out.
Yeah, the stories and the characters is what draws me to comics. And they did a thing during the paranoid thing where, you know, I was going to be a superhero and you know, I'd roll under the ring and I worked... I loved it, man. I'm wearing a mask and I had a cape and, you know, all this stuff. We're good buddies with Shane Helms, Gregory Helms.
Yeah,
good buddies
great
with him.
Guy.
And I talked to him about it in great length. And I did about a year of house shows and I worked Kip, Billy Gunn, on every show as a super. I would wrestle him as Eric Young and he'd, great big giant guy, knock me around for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes and then I'd roll into the ring and put the Super Eric on. I mean, I'm half his size and I would come up with the mask and stuff on and he'd backpedal and I would knock him around and he's bumping all over the place. Great guy, man. I mean,
hey, tell me about working underneath the hood,
mm-hmm.
because, and to my fans that don't know what underneath the hood is, but behind the mask, you know, basically that's what I'm referring to, because I mean, on one hand, I can imagine it could be very easy, but by the same token, extremely hard. How was it for you?
Yeah, it would be a weird thing, I think, to wrestle under the hood for a long period of time or to debut, because no one gets to really see you. You know what I mean? Like you're now 100% a character, you know, like no one really knows what you look like and you can't translate that over to something. I mean, in Mexico they can, you know, Blue Panther back in the day had his own television show where he wore his mask on the television show as he'd wear a tuxedo and he wore his mask and stuff. But it, you know, in the United States, I mean, that doesn't exist. But for me, I mean, like I said, I get hot thinking about it being hot and I made sure that I had the bottom part with my mouth open because, you know, I've just had nightmares about getting so blown up and wanting to pull the mask off.
It's so hard. Not only the heat, hard to breathe, a little on the claustrophobic side,
yeah.
I would certainly imagine, but so hard to convey emotions.
Yeah.
Without all of your facial features.
Definitely all physical. And the benefit of being the superhero, it's all, for me, it was like all arm gestures and pointing
posture.
How I stood and how I ran. And when I did that, I tried, I would, you know, in one match, I could be scared Eric Young at the start, roll into the ring, put the mask and the shirt and the gold pants on and come out as Super Eric. And I would wrestle completely different because he's confident. He's a superhero. He's from another planet and has super strength. So, I mean, I love the challenge of it. You know, the challenge of it was very difficult. And but people, I mean, the Super Eric character was crazy over.
So what happened to it?
Don't know. They just stopped using it.
Just stopped using it. That's interesting. You know, back in the day when I first came into WWF, I was traveling with Dustin Rhodes.
Yeah.
And my mother actually went to high school with Dusty Rhodes in Austin, Texas. And anyways, me and Dustin are good buddies, and he's Gold Dust.
Yep.
And I tell you what, mister, Dustin was the hottest heel in the world.
Yep.
He had so much heat, and they were dumping a lot of gasoline on him and keeping him hot. And then all of a sudden, there was a little bit of backlash. Well, there was a lot of backlash, and man, they just chopped the legs off that gimmick. And just, I mean, it totally spun Dustin's career. Because, man, we would go to the buildings, and I'd be working in the mid-card. I was still on my way up, and Dustin was working in the mains, you know, with Shawn Michaels or anybody else, and just getting a hell of a response. And, of course, Dustin's a badass worker, and it was a great gimmick. But, well, man, once the company decides, hey, not so much anymore.
That's it.
You know, it ain't your ball game. You're just kind of playing ball with them.
Yep.
The promotion's everything.
Yep.
It can be a real pain in the ass.
Yeah, it sure can. Yeah, and Dustin's a good dude. Actually, Super Eric wrestled Dustin. He was in TNA as Black Rain, kind of like a version, like a real dark version of the Gold Dust character. And I mean, what a great guy. Great guy to be in the ring with. Did a bunch of stuff with him as the superhero character and the Black Rain. He was kind of like the evil villain to my, the superhero character. And, I learned so much from him, man.
Me and that guy worked snug. I mean, just right snug. I ain't talking about stiff Japan strong style. I'm talking about snug. Yeah, proper snug. You got it. So I can't ask Dustin. I'm going to have him on the show. But so I can ask you, as Super Eric, all of a sudden, not so much with that character. Mm-hmm. You're still in the company, a long run to go.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that affect you mentally when they say, okay, we're changing this character, we're just going to shit can it all together, but we want to be in business with Eric Young and move forward? Do you hold any animosity? Do you just let it go? Like you said earlier, is just, hey, that's the wrestling business?
Yeah. I mean, that is the wrestling business. You know, like, it's disappointing, you know. It's hard not to show disappointment and stuff because the character, one, it was so fun for me.
When you believe in something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know how it is. Like, if you know, for me, it's just, it's over. We don't need to fight upstream all the time. Like, he was popular. You could just put him on TV, you know, real easy stuff. But, you know, that they decided to go a different direction, and the guard has changed in TNA. You know, this guy's writing, and, you know, you get over with him for a little bit, and then that guy's gone, and now this guy's writing. And then, you know, you get over with him, and then this guy's writing. And that's happened, you know, probably five or six times while I've been at TNA, and it's like you start at the bottom, you work your way back up. You start at the bottom, you work your way back up. But, I mean, I've been employed since 2004. No complaints from me, man. And I've done all kinds of crazy stuff, like different characters. I've seen it all.
The Showtime Eric Young character that we see today, who is, what is that guy?
Now it's I'm learning as I go now because of the show and the popularity of the show on Animal Planet. That Eric Young is more who I am. You know, that's the guy that you see on the television show is definitely, and I think I heard this, you said this in an interview, you know, like Steve Austin that you see on Raw is you just turned way up. And that's who I think Eric Young will be now going forward. You know, I'm still going to be funny. I'm still going to do things that I think are fun, but I'm going to do them on purpose, which I think is cool, you know.
Right.
Like, we had the match with Aries, and, you know, ODB slides in the ring, and I that was my idea to do the waist lock on her and take her down. It's funny, you know, you're not going to really see that, but from other people, I can get away with it because that's who I am. And I'm not doing it because I'm mentally challenged. I'm doing it because I want to.
Right.
And to me, there's nothing cooler than that.
Right.
Yeah, and that's where I think it's going because of the popularity of the show, and everyone sees it, and they're like, well, why isn't he... You know, why isn't he afraid, or why isn't he, you know, locking up with the fishermen, or why isn't he taking his pants off, and, you know, stuff like that. So that's going to pass by. So now it's kind of like a crazy cool version of Eric Young, which it's a good place to be for me, I think.
Well, what is the folks at Animal Planet, with you being the host of that show and is very successful, looking for future endeavors with other projects with those people, what do they think about your wrestling gig?
Yeah, they think it's cool, man. You know, like, I think it's fascinating to people from the television world, as you well know. I'm sure you get a million questions doing Redneck Island saying, you know, what's that like? You know, and when you explain it to them, they're like, really? You know, it's, there's no world like it. You know, it's on television. It's part of television, but it can't really be compared to anything else. And, you know, you doing your television stuff and been in movies and stuff, you know, it literally is two different worlds, two completely different worlds. And, they're fascinated by it. They like it. You know, the cross promotion of it, stuff like
one
that.
One hand feeds the other, definitely.
Yeah, one hand feeds the other. You know, they hopefully they both can scratch each other's backs. That's what I hope for. It's good for both. Me being on the wrestling show is good for Animal Planet, and me being on Animal Planet is good for the wrestling show. So, you know, Spike and Animal Planet, I know they aired some of the clips with me and ODB, one of the episodes from Minnesota, and it's good for everyone. Good for me especially, but good for both companies.
You get guys coming up to you in a dressing room pitching your shows now.
Oh, yeah. 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 Well, get me on.
You know, but it goes back to, you get in the business, get out of the business. Well, you know, yeah, that's what they used to say back in the day, but then you follow up with the business and you don't want to get out. But then you see a gig like you've got, and hey, yeah, I can see myself doing that.
Yeah.
I can't see myself going back to the other day. How are you dealing with all that bullshit?
It's fun.
And I know guys mean it in the right way.
Yeah, it's fun. It's, you know, like you said, like, you know, everyone's got their ideas and I think I could come on the show and do this and stuff. And, you know, it's fun. And the coolest part for me is everyone's been super supportive. Everyone from the wrestling industry, period, you know, from you to Shawn Michaels, Lance Storm was talking to me a little bit today, Christian Edge, like buddies of mine that I've known for a long time, and everyone from both companies have been super supportive. I think it's just good for pro wrestling, period. For, you know, having some, you know, guys go outside, you know, kind of Hulk, I think, kind of like paved the way for us. And then the, you know, you and Rock and guys stepping outside of pro wrestling. And, I'm not putting myself in that group, but I am in the group of having a thing outside of pro wrestling, which shines light on pro wrestling, which makes pro wrestlers look more like just, you know, muscled Neanderthals, you know, because which a lot of people think we are.
Agreed. And, you know, through this show, I've actually been able to show a sense of humor, which I have. And I'd rather laugh than beat somebody up any day of the week. But to your point, you made 15 minutes ago, you know, people think that I'm going to be mad, pissed off, and drinking beer all the time.
Right.
No. I actually like to laugh and shoot the shit and take it easy every now and then
That would be exhausting.
It would be exhausting. What's your relationship like with Dixie Carter?
It's good. Yeah, I've always got along really well with Dixie.
Nice lady, understands the business and vision.
Really, really nice lady. And what I think most importantly about Dixie is she's a smart businesswoman and has made good business decisions, moving TNA forward, where they didn't get too big for their britches. You know, it was baby steps where they didn't like, oh, now we're going to do this, and they tried to like bypass a bunch of steps. You know, I think they're pretty aware that they're number two, and you know, there's the WWE,
and that's
and
okay
else.
Being number two.
It's great being number
two. You're talking about it. You know, when you're talking about a company like WWF, WWE, everybody knows I call them F.
Mm-hmm.
It is what it is. No one's going to knock those people off. I don't give a shit how much money you got. It ain't going to happen. There's too much history.
Yep.
There's too much tradition. There's too much smarts. There's too much guts. It's just too much everything and too much talent. And to that, I also say TNA has a lot of talent in that locker room.
Yeah.
But that's not going to happen. But competition is always good in everything.
Yep.
And people, like again, when people ask me, like, oh, you watch TNA? Well, you're damn right I do, man. Yeah, I want those guys and gals to have jobs down there. And I like a different presentation. I like a different look.
That's right.
I like to see what other minds are thinking, because it's all of what happens in a squared circle. What can be done differently? You know, so you look to both of them, and I'm glad that everybody has jobs where they do, and I wish nothing but the best for TNA.
Yeah, and it's vice versa for the guys there, you know, all the guys that work there. You know, I don't think there's not a competition. You know, like, we're on Thursdays, they're on Monday and Fridays. There's plenty of pie to eat, you know, for everybody. And, you know, it's good to have a variety and have something else to watch and have a different creative prospect and outlook on what's going on. And it's all good, man. And she's a smart lady, man. Super smart lady.
Eric, thanks for coming to my crib, hanging out, shooting the shit. You're welcome back anytime to the Steve Austin Show.
Appreciate it, Steve. Had a blast, man.
Spring's coming fast, and your lawn's about to kick out of old man's winter's finish. So listen up, because you need to get your lawn in order. As someone who likes my lawn to be main event level, I can tell you that our yard can take a real beating. Bugs, heat, drought, weak, thin jabroni grass, and so many damn weeds you think it was the Royal Rumble. Well, our new sponsor, Scott's Turf Builder, has the components you need for a thick, green, lush lawn. All it takes is four simple feedings to help crowd out pesky weeds by creating a greener, stronger lawn. Feedings multiple times throughout the year with Scott's makes your lawn durable and more resilient. Just once in early spring, late spring, summer, and fall for a greener, stronger lawn all year long. Scott's will give your yard the nourishment it needs to help your weak, thin lawn recover. And Scott's stands by their no-quibble money-back guarantee. If you're not satisfied, you get your money back. Start your Scott's Turf Builder program today, because this is a Scott's Yard. All right, I'm giving Sean a go-home cue, so let's wrap it up for this week. Make sure you check out podcast1.com and subscribe to the Steve Austin Show so you don't miss any of these classic episodes. Before I ride off in the sunset, I do want to throw out a couple of plugs. I still got a beer. It's the badass Broken Skull IPA, the finest IPA in the United States of America, and that's the bottom line. Made by El Segundo Brewing Company. You can find Broken Skull IPA at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in Cali. If you ain't in Cali, you're probably SOL. And if you're looking to get a badass pocket knife, I got two for you. Cold steel Broken Skull knife, cold steel working man knife. Get them at my Amazon store, amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin, or go to the Cold Steel Knives website and check out all their badass knives. Also, one more big shout out to all my sponsors to make this show possible. That's how I'm able to bring this show to you free twice a week. Please support them because they support us. For more info, check out the podcast description to this episode for details. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at Steve Austin BSR. Folks, I'll be back soon, but until then, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.